Short and Sweet with 42nd Street Pete. And here's your host, Pete Chiarella, only on Jackalope Radio.
And we are live. It's Friday night, and Gary's here already. Gary, welcome back to the show. As always, great to have you on.
Thank you, Pete. I feel I'm at home every time I talk to you on this show.
It's
like sitting around the wood stove at the Cracker Barrel or something.
Sitting around the campfire, passing the bong and drinking the wine back in the old
Absolutely.
Days.
Or down at the tracks with that can of Sterno and some Beanie Weenies and some really good Dago Red. It's just wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Dago Red, I haven't heard that in years.
I know. It's not PC today, I guess, but it used to be the thing, man.
They don't even know what we're talking about. That's the funny part about it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Italian backer, and they used to call it Guinea Red, too.
Did they really?
Yeah. It was basically just like a regular red wine that was, you know, cheaper by the gallon.
Yeah. It's funny how so many of the terms that we used to like I'm a bit Irish, and it didn't bother me to be called a Mick. I always kind of liked it, you know, and the insults were more kind of funny than they it was a way of teasing each other. But now it carries such venom with it. I don't understand. It's a different world. I'm not complaining.
Yeah, I don't know. We had this one weird spin-off show called The Dark Guy's Pleasure Chest. I think you can still hear the archives. But the only reason we did it was because somebody had this show called The Dark Girl's Pleasure Chest, and she flipped out, so Todd needed to fill the space. So I think it was me, Griffin, McClaws, and Todd Chip chimed in, and we basically, the second show we opened with 98 ethnic and sexual stereotype racial insults. And I just read them off deadpan, and when I ended, I think Todd or Griff goes, and that's our target audience.
That's funny.
That's the problem. Right. People can't poke fun at each other anymore without it getting, you know, crazy.
Yeah, I know. It used to be a way of, you know, getting tighter, you know, bonding a little bit. Like hitting each other on the arm, all the old rituals. I don't know.
Now, if you hit me on the arm, I sue you for assault.
I know it. I got to have my attorney with me. Jesus. Todd, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, my friend. How about yourself? You've been hanging in there, doing good things?
Yeah. Now, didn't you go through? I went. I got off chemo in July.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I thought I was 20 again, and I had no immune system, so I just did everything. I did a couple of projects, and then Christmas came, and I partied like I was 3. I haven't partied that much for 20 years. I had a blast, and then around January, I came down with pneumonia. I mean, what do you expect? I looked at someone, and I'd get sick. So I had pneumonia, and then now I'm just getting back. I'm over that. Now I'm getting my voice back. I had strep throat, the whole thing with it. So now I'm back. I can walk. I can talk. I'm going to live. So now, how about you?
I wondered why you didn't call me back that time. And then you sent me the email that you had pneumonia.
Yeah. I was pretty sick for a little while. But what the heck? That's life. Yeah, there was a thing going around. In fact, I had my buddy, Darwin McTighe, who lives in Medford, California, said it's a disease that's attacking old white men, which was this lung thing that went around this year. I had more buddies my age who came down with the same thing in different parts of the country, you know, sort of a bronchitis pneumonia thing together that ended up putting some of them in the hospital. So, I don't know. It's life, I guess. We all get something. Why are we even talking?
I know. I wound up getting the flu this year, too, and I haven't had it in years. Mm. But it was a thing where they said it was like, for me, it was like 4 days. They said you probably had gotten this before because it was around years ago.
Yeah.
So whatever it was, but it sucked anyway. I hate being sick.
Did you have the shots?
No, I'm against the shots. I don't trust them. Something creeps me out about the whole deal. The one time I did get a shot, I came down with a full-blown case of the flu, and I was, like, sick for 2 weeks. So I'll take my chances.
Man, I'm like you. I hate being sick. I just hate it. But, you know.
I tend to avoid people in the winter. That seems to be the best bet.
Yeah, yeah. Austin has a period. We're right in it now that's just full of allergies, and it goes from cedar fever to oak, and I'm allergic to all of them. At first, I wasn't, and you come to Austin, and it just seems wonderful. Todd, you've been here.
I love it, like, yeah.
The air is perfect and wonderful, and you can see the stars at night, but it's also the allergy capital of the U.S., and most people don't know that. It just goes full-blown, man, for 3 months.
I started getting something up here because of the ragweed. There's a lot of ragweed.
So,
and I like to sleep with the windows. I like to sleep with the windows open in the summer for the breeze, but it wasn't helping.
Yeah, sure. Well, they've got South by Southwest going on here. That's the big film festival for the South, and it's a music. First of all, they have a week of interactive video going on, so all those the gamers are in town. And then for a week and a half, it's film and music. And then the film ends after a full week, and it's music only for another week. So the town is just totally bonkers for like 2.5 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, you can't even move. A lot of stuff going on, though.
Sounds like fun, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. There's always something of one kind or another going on in this town that's almost free. The musicians and stuff don't make a lot of money, but they make a lot of noise, and they get a lot of publicity out of here. So they still like to come and play the gigs and, you know, get on stage if they can. And the same with the film. It's a big thing now to play South by Southwest. So, yeah.
Well, you were talking about this film, The Last 40 Miles?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you in that one?
Yeah. I'm so proud of this, Pete. At first, it's a short film, and it was made by an Englishman with an American crew. He wrote the script, and it's about the death penalty, and it doesn't make a statement either way, although the way he shoots it, you end up being pretty much against it. And it's a guard taking a black prisoner, young guy, from one city to the other where he's going to be executed. And I played the guard. And the guy playing the prisoner is named Victor Steele. He is so good. Anyway, the thing that I wanted to mention, and I may have mentioned it last time, I've talked about it before, is it's rotoscoped. You know, it's drawn in. It's animation over the actors. And when they first did that, like we did green screen, we did all our lines driving in the van and all of his lines, and then they rotoscoped it and drew in the backgrounds and drew in things that, you know, made an artistic rendering. You guys know what rotoscoping is.
Yeah, yeah.
When they finished it, I don't know why they're doing that. I know Richard Linklater made a whole feature that way, Autumn Awakening or Awaken Autumn or something, and I didn't care for it. I just thought, don't ruin a good film. And anyway, when I saw it as screening, I thought it was so well done, and I saw it why it worked the way it did. If they had shot it for real, with me and the actor, real, either black or white or color, but real in person, our images, it wouldn't have been as powerful as it was rotoscoped. It's us, and it's our voices, and the guy playing the actor. It was a great, great chance to be moving with your voice, because the characters were us, but they were drawn in. But our voices were real, and unless you believed this kid, this black kid, then the whole thing is blown. You're not going to go along with it, because he's doing all the talking as we ride along, telling about his past and how he got to this point. So he starts talking, and the camera, the rotoscope, the picture, go goes to what he's talking about. He talks about his childhood, and so gradually he gets deeper and deeper into his childhood, and we see more and more of it, but it's drawn. The childhood is drawn. The mom fixing the apple pie, the fishing down by the river, all of those things, and we hear his voice. If we didn't like that voice, if we didn't take that trip, you wouldn't care. But the casting was so good that the voice worked, so that by the end, it ends with me saying, "Well, Ray, are you ready?" Which means he's going to go in and be killed. And by that time, you like him so much that you don't want him to be killed. So that's what I mean by it's kind of a statement against it. You realize, hey, wait a minute, this kid doesn't deserve it, and it's not going to solve anything. Anyway, I'm very proud of it, and I thought this is going to make some news at some of the conventions and some of the festivals. And already it's just being booked on all these different festivals. And the director was telling me, like, we just got accepted into the New Orleans Festival, and I know we have a big one coming up Monday. He hasn't told me which one it is yet. He just said it's going to be a big surprise. But it works at the festivals, and it doesn't surprise me because of the rotoscope. There's not going to be another film there for sure that's rotoscoped. And certainly, if it was, it's not going to work like this one works. Anyway, that's enough. I'm going on and on, but I'm very
Was it just like you and this other actor who played the kid? That was the only cast?
Yeah, there is a driver, and he has a couple of lines. But you go back, and he talks about his mother, and you'll see his mother for a minute. But she's a total drawn in. There wasn't an actress playing it, so it's just a cartoon rendering of his mother. And his grandfather, when he went fishing down by the river for catfish. And those people are drawn in. Other prisoners are drawn in, because it's his third time in prison. Only this time it's going to be his last time. So it's just, it's hard to explain, but it's just so, well, yeah, there is a driver. And the guy talks about his good luck is twice he's been up for execution, and on the way, he had a Whataburger, which is a big burger here in Texas, a great, great burger, like the In-N-Out burger in L.A. So everybody loves him, and he always got one on the way, and then by the time he got there, there was a stay of execution. So this time, we stop, and I buy him that burger. I think, well, one more time, it won't hurt, only this time it doesn't save him. And it's kind of a poignant moment, because the driver, that's where he has his one line. He goes in and gets the burger, and he comes back out. So it's just normal things. You want onions and mustard and relish, and this guy that's going to be dead in an hour is ordering his last burger. It's kind of powerful, really, in its way.
Really sounds good. I really want to see this.
Yeah, I'll make sure you get a copy if you'd like to see it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It just sounds... I've never seen this before. I mean, I've seen like anime, you know, that was, or animation, like, I think, you know, Ralph Bashke did a lot of this stuff with like Fire and Ice, where he used the Leo Gourd and Steve Sandor as voiceovers and stuff.
Right,
but
right.
This sounds like, you know, something night and day from that.
Yeah, it's really, it surprised me how much I liked it. And I took with me to the screening some film people that were heavy, heavy into film. And they were very, no, rotoscope, we're not going for it. We don't care. All right, we'll take a look. And they ended up liking it also. They thought, gee, that's really good. It really worked. So, and that brought about the whole discussion of where film is going. Todd, maybe you can get on this. Where is it going? Is it going to be, you know, a combination of art and film and live and shorter? They say the audience today doesn't need the long film anymore, the 90 minutes, the hour and a half to 2 hours for a film. They'd be just as happy to see one in 20 minutes if it worked.
Well, you know, we're on that thing. Corey is going to call in. I'm just giving you the green light, Corey. Call in because you're being polite and holding off because you didn't want to interrupt the flow, which I appreciate. But you're a filmmaker, so call in, dude. You know, we're here.
Absolutely.
Todd's a filmmaker. I mean, you know, I would like to try something down the road, you know, actually to try to make some kind of film. I got some. I got a script out with somebody that's, you know, a little bit nuts and crazy and shit. But we'll see where that goes. But yeah, I just, you know, before my career is over or whatever, I'd like to give it a shot. You know,
Do you want to direct it or produce it or both?
I don't know if I want. You know, I've never really, you know, aspired to be a director. I think I would be a hell of a heavy. You know, that type of thing. I think where I would work like that. You know, as far as writing something, I was writing something for the magazine, and it got really stretched out a little bit. And then the editor said, you know, this might go as a standalone novel, because this was another one of those little drunken sit downs where we said, hey, why don't we do this? And I said, why don't we come up with a post apocalyptic spaghetti western where there's no water. Whatever happened, there was some kind of solar flare and it destroyed all the drinking water and stuff. And all that's left is alcohol, and any water is like precious. And there's just these bunch of drunken lunatics that are shooting each other over water and things. So, you know, I just came up with it. I wrote it, you know, and I pretty much wrote a character that mirrors me in there. And, you know, we were kicking around, but I says, well, let me write it as some kind of, you know, like short story thing and just, drop it in and see what happens. And I think Corey's calling out. Is your thing lighting up, Todd, or anything?
Now it is, yeah.
It is?
Yeah. There we go.
It's lighting up. Okay.
Yay.
Hey, Corey.
I am here, gentlemen.
You're here. Well.
Hey, Corey, how you doing?
I'm good, Gary. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm surviving.
It sounds like you've recovered from a lot lately, so.
Yeah, I have. I'm back among the walking living. Whatever. Hey, it's good to hear you. So what's going on? What's happening?
Well, I was talking to Pete earlier, and he said Gary Kent's going to be the guest, and I was very excited to hear that, because I had a chance to briefly, very, very briefly, meet you at Cinema Wasteland last April, which was exciting that you were a guest at Cinema Wasteland. And you know, just knowing your resume and everything you've done and working with the people that you've worked with, and the fact that the new film you were just talking about that you're still working, it's amazing. It's a, you know, it's an honor to get to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, Cinema Wasteland, I love that convention. I love it. And as far as you're still working, just God bless, you know, whatever, the vapors or something, because I'm enjoying it as much as I ever did, except I can't do stunts anymore. I can fake it, but that's about it.
Yeah. I know that feeling, because somebody was talking to me about wrestling the other day, and they said, well, you tried to do something, and I says, any aspirations I ever had of doing that are out the window at this stage of the game.
Yeah.
I ain't that fucking stupid anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. When it goes, and you know it.
Oh,
you know it.
Well, it's funny. Me and Corey were talking, and maybe you remember this guy. You remember Billy Robinson?
I don't.
He's a British wrestler? Well, he just passed away last week. And,
oh, wait,
you know,
a minute.
Corey,
yeah, I do. Okay, sure.
Okay,
yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, he was big in the Midwest, and I didn't know that he was training men and women for the MMA.
Hmm.
That's what he's been doing. And I remember
he passed away. How old was he?
74.
Oh, 74.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, he was one of those guys that was like legit, where he was a shooter, and he trained James Marantano, who worked as Little Guido in ECW and Nunzio in the WWE.
Right.
So
right.
He was no joke. So
yeah.
I just found it interesting that, you know, he was I know he was doing a lot of stuff with the women after he stopped working himself, because I caught something on cable one night, and then you know, I had no clue he was doing this. I just found it interesting. And, you know, you being a stunt man, you know, and that stunt in wrestling, you know, sort of goes hand in hand. I figured you would have heard of him.
Yeah. Did I tell you that Bob Ivey, who played the mummy and Bubba Hotep, and did this big stunt show? We did. He's done a ton of car roles and car work. Growing up, his uncle was the king of wrestling booking all throughout the South. And I know you'd know his name if I could remember it, and I can't. I meant to write it down. But he was huge. He put on all the things in Houston, the big wrestling shows that came out of Houston.
Oh, Paul Bosch?
Von Erich.
One of those guys. Paul Bosch, I think.
Probably
Paul Bosch,
so. That sounds.
Houston would have been Paul Bosch, I think.
He was huge. Yeah, he just controlled the whole thing. Made a fortune in wrestling, putting on the shows. And Bob used to go down, and once in a while, he would let him announce about. Bob was like 10 or 11.
Yeah. Corey wrestled. He did.
I was a manager. I was a pro wrestling manager.
Were you really?
Yeah, I did that. I worked for a radio station, and I used to play all these little funny lines from some of the wrestlers. You know, you'd throw in Baron Von Raschke or something over a song. I'd play a little bit from them, and the guy that was promoting up there, starting his own federation, got in touch and said, hey, you should come down and do some of this, manage or ring announce or something. And I said, I'd love to. And boy, I got my ass handed to me a couple of times, and I'm about 5'6", about 160 pounds, and yeah, you get a 300-pound guy picking you up and dropping you on the top of your head, and I'm making my chiropractor still in a higher tax bracket after all these years.
Wow, where was this?
This was up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, not far from the Twin Cities.
I see. Well, I'll be damned. So how long were you into it? How long were you managing?
Oh, wow. I think I worked for a couple of different federations. About 6 years, 7 years, kind of off and on. Did it full-time almost every weekend for about 3 years. And after that, just kind of, and what was funny was initially when I got in, the guy that was doing the promoting and booking, and it was during the... kind of the resurgence of wrestling during WWF when they had The Rock and those guys going on. So wrestling just in and of itself was a big ticket, it was a big show every time any kind of wrestling would hit town. And he would book and promote 1,700 people in a gymnasium, 2,000 people, sold out, good stuff. And then as the years went by and wrestling kind of went down, I wound up managing for in front of four people at a baseball diamond. So it was it fell off quick.
I almost managed a guy when Doug from RF was still around. There was this kid who was working as the Grim Reaper, and his gimmick was that he smoked pot.
Right.
He was a great worker. A high flyer. The crowd loved him, and Doug's idea was, he goes, well, you're a pothead. Why don't we go up there? You come out in your gimmick carrying a bong, playing up in smoke, and you can, blow smoke in the guy's face at the end and shit. So I said, yeah, I'm down for it. But, like everything else, it never happened.
Oh, man, that would have been great.
Yeah, it would be funny.
Wow. You should resurrect that now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now's the time.
Wrestling sort of sucks now. I don't watch it anymore because I don't have cable, but everybody says
yeah.
It sucks.
Yeah, is it, why? Is it because of the ultimate fighting going on, or?
Now, you know what I think it was?
Even boxing's taken a hit. Even boxing isn't.
Well, you know what it is? Since McMahon exposed it, as, we all knew, there were marks, and there were, smart marks that knew what was going on and stuff.
Right.
Once they took away that whole, let's build up a storyline to a certain point where, when you had guys like Ole Anderson and Ivan Koloff out there cutting promos, and they were so intense that you genuinely feared for the guy they were talking about. You just don't have that anymore. You just don't have it.
Yeah.
So
why not?
It's a cartoon show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a big thing that's happened, though, too, is the fact that McMahon now has basically... And I read something about it online, but it's a training facility where they basically just take guys who fit a mold, whether they've been on the independent wrestling circuit, or they've come up through Ring of Honor or TNA or anything else. But they just mold guys in their training facility. So everybody that hits, you know, WWE TV has been trained the exact same way, to tell a story the same way and to wrestle a certain way. And I think that's, you know, that was the thing that I think hit so big, you know, in the 80s, with, you know, the Hulk Hogan and things, because all these guys came from different walks of life. They all had different people that had trained them and different, worked different territories and with different people. And so they had a different perspective and a different way to tell a story. So every match was, you know, had its own sort of style to it. Whereas now I think it just has the Vince McMahon style.
Yeah, you're right. You know, you're right. It's, Corey, it's just very much that way now.
Well, you know what it was? They had, I don't know if you guys remember, either you guys ever watch ECW when that was on? It was back in the...
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You'll remember this angle. This is what they did. There was this wrestler called the Sandman, whose gimmick was he came in with a Singapore cane, a can of beer, smoking a cigarette. He was like the most over, you know, guy in the company. So they ran this thing, was he was supposed to cane, you know, the hero, Tommy Dreamer. And at a key moment, something happened and Tommy Dreamer smashed the lit cigarette into his face and blinded him. They broke character. They started calling each other by their real names, get an ambulance, this, that, and the other thing. They worked this for months. The Sandman never came out of his house for months. Nobody saw the guy for months. They finally bring the guy back, you know, the retirement thing. He comes in, you know, with patches over his eyes and stuff and working around it. Nobody knew anything in the middle of the whole, you know, this guy's, how sorry I am. He pulls off the patches and beats the shit out of him. Mm. Nobody saw it coming.
Mm.
And that's the beauty of it. It worked. Everybody bought it for the 6 months they were running it, you know?
Sure.
Well, you gotta let that stuff breathe. I mean, now it's all just hot-shotting angles. I mean, even if you look at WWE now with WrestleMania 30, the 30th anniversary of WrestleMania, I think they only have 3 matches set. The thing is a couple of weeks away. You know, those matches should have been set 8-10 months ago.
Yeah,
They brought back Hulk Hogan. I'm going to vomit.
Yeah, I mean...
Please.
Maybe they'll bring Sting in for you, Pete.
Even if I had the cheat box, I wouldn't watch it. I wouldn't waste 3 hours of my time right now watching it. That's how it doesn't do anything for me. You know, it's not.
Yeah, I hear you. I know.
But when you grew up watching guys like Bruno Sammartino and George the Animal Steele, who at points were legitimately beating the shit out of each other, you know, it's really kind of hard to like look at the shit anymore. You know.
Well, I remember, you know, like I said, where I was growing up too, it was that was AWA. That was our guy up there was Vern Gagne. So I mean, it was Jerry Blackwell, Ray the Crippler Stevens, Colonel DeBeers, Nick Bockwinkel. I mean, we had, you know, these guys coming through town all the time. It was the only thing on television, and this was back in the days when you would watch it and go, "These guys are going to kill each other."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Boots just came in and stuck her cold nose in my hand.
Hey, Boots, how you doing?
Well, the guy said hello, Boots. Now leave me alone. I'm working, kid. It's like having your children barge in your office, you know?
Right.
Hey, Todd, have you talked to Ted? We were trying to get Ted to come on. We were trying to swing that, but I don't know.
Ted, Michael?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Oh, man, what a gas that would have been.
Yeah,
Ted,
we can hook that up down the road. That's not a problem. We would just.
How's he
doing?
Anyway.
Corey talked to him. Last time I talked to him, he's just so excited about making this new movie.
Oh, he's thrilled about the new movie. Yeah, and he actually, I think he just wrapped shooting within the last couple of weeks. So the whole movie's in the can. And so Ted will go back now and work his magic for a few months. But yeah, he's super excited about the new movie. I remember him calling and saying he had the title for it immediately. And of course, you know, we all know, and Gary, you know, I mean, from being in some of Ted's movies, One Shocking Moment and The Black Klansman, and knowing Ted's proficiency in coming up with a great title for a movie. He called. Yeah. He was excited with Paranormal Extremes. He said, "Text messages from the dead." And he was very excited about that.
Now, didn't he shoot part of that in Europe?
I know he did part of Demon Haunt about 5 years, 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
No, he's,
I know
he's
he was
got,
over
he,
in England.
He told me he's got a bunch of people all over the world that just shoot stuff for him. Because that,
oh,
that
yeah, they did that with the last Astro Zombies.
Yeah,
he had
people. He had people like shooting the Eiffel Tower and all these like historic landmarks just so Ted could blow them up with CG stuff.
Wow,
it was great. I mean, I enjoyed the hell out of it. It was great. You know?
Sure, Ted is a showman, man. He really is. He's a showman.
Yeah, I remember one of those Astro Zombie movies, and it was bad. I think it was the second one, but it was like one where he had, like, it was a metal colander with the holes punched out with Christmas lights in it. And I'm looking at this, I'm going, only Ted. You know, only Ted would do this and pull it off, you know?
Yeah.
Gotta love it.
You gotta love the guy. You got to. Well, it's good to hear that he's excited about his movie and that he got it in the can. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, he's what was funny was because that's been the thing that I've been most proud of, you know, throughout everything is that Ted has given me a chance to write the last to write three of the last four movies for him. And,
really?
So that was Demon Haunt, and that was Astro Zombies M3 cloned, and then Paranormal Extremes, and
you wrote those?
Yeah.
Oh, Corey, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well,
yep.
Man, that's cool.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's been I'm so proud of that. And, you know, because Ted had come off, well, he had done Heart of a Boy, which was kind of his foray into family-type film. And, you know, I mean, it was a good movie, of course, but it wasn't met with much fanfare and much success for him. So when Ted and I first got to know each other really well, he was looking for the next project, and he said, I got to go back into horror. So he wanted me to try to come up with a horror movie for him, and so he and I came up with Demon Haunt, and yeah, it's neat. It's funny because, you know, I know, you know, budgetary constraints and, you know, the fact that, and Pete and I talked about this too, you know, that Ted's not a big fan of gore, so he doesn't want to put a lot of that in the movies and things, so I know the constraints, so I'll start writing something, and I'll try to, like with Demon Haunt, I tried to keep it low-key, and I tried to keep any effects to a minimum, and so, you know, I delivered a 95-page script to Ted, and, you know, it was within budgetary constraints that I knew Ted would be working with, and time constraints and things, and before I knew it, Ted calls me, and he said, Cardi, we're going to do this all CG! He's talking about, he's like, he's going to go crazy, he's got CG demons popping out of hell and all of this, and I said, only Ted.
Yeah, oh, man. Yeah. Now, how did you meet Ted, as long as we're on the subject?
I was, because I had gotten familiarized with Ted's movies from, of course, you know, the video stores, seeing Astro Zombies and Corpse Grinders, you know, and
sure.
there was a TV show that was called The Incredibly Strange Film Show that was on, I think, about 1986.
Yeah.
And it was Jonathan Ross hosted, and it was on cable, and it was Ed Wood, and of course, and Gary, you worked with Ray Dennis Steckler, and he was on the show, and Ted, and I just remember seeing Ted's episode, and it started out, and Ted's in the desert playing an accordion, singing Roll Out the Barrel, and then he's got a ventriloquist dummy, and they're just crazy things, and once I started to go online and just look up names, and, you know, people that I'm like, why, you know, I haven't heard anything from Ted B. Michaels in a while, and I just found his website, and I dropped an email to it, and not thinking Ted would ever see it or reply to it or anything, I just composed an email and said I just wanted to write Ted and let him know that I'm a big fan of his work, and I want to thank him for, you know, the years of entertainment and inspiration, and before I know it, I have an email back, and it's just Ted himself. He said, you know, give me a call sometime, here's my number, and so that was that, and I called
him,
and, yeah, that's pure Ted, though.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great story.
And I got to be around when Kevin Michaels was making the documentary film on him, and I was able to see that whole process, and I was able to go to the world premiere of M3 Cloned out in Las Vegas, and I got to meet Tura before she passed away too. So that was very, very nice.
Wow, yeah. Was Speckler there?
I didn't see Ray there. I know he was still in Vegas, of course. It was before he had passed away. I don't know. Is that video store that he had, is anybody still running that out in Vegas?
Somebody said somebody is.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. You know, I don't know, but one of the, big film exhibition guys here in town with the Alamo Theater Group is a guy named Zach Carlson, who loves Ray Steckler. And every 2 or 3 months, he has a party where he shows Thrill Killers, or one of Ray's movies. And he just went, he told me at lunch the other day, he just went to Vegas and went to that video store because they were having a big auction of Ray's films, and a lot of them autographed and family pictures. And he went and he bought a few items while there. So evidently the store is still going.
What was the name of that? I can't remember the name of the store.
I can't either.
I just knew it was there.
Yeah, actually, I know that he had all of his stuff there for years and years. He was had all of his titles, and he was running the store. And
he had pictures on the wall from his films. Actually, I heard he had 3 stores, or he ended up with 3 stores.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, well, that wasn't hard. You know, if you're the only game in town, why not? You know.
Yeah.
Locations. That's a smart business move.
Sure is.
That's sad though that we lost him too. Shit. You know, that's what kills me. I mean, you know, I get in these online brawls, which I'm sick of even starting anymore, even defending anything. You know, the fact that, like, you know, guys like Gary, Ted, you know, Ray, all these guys, you know, they were the ones who, you know, started all this stuff. And it's like, I just, you know, in my mind, you know, they're not invited to conventions and things like that. I just don't get it, because every time I walk away from, you know, talking with Gary or Ted or any of these guys, I come away with something I didn't know before. You know, that's what I don't understand. Just me bitching. That's all. It's the truth. You know, we were having this argument. Actually, I was supposed to be at Horror Realm this weekend. And the reason I pulled out was, I mean, they treat me right. They give me a table. They pay for my room. And my deal is I show 2 16mm films.
Right.
Well, first time we did it, okay. You know, only a couple people showed up. Maybe 3. All right. It was new. I was making County Line and Nightmare on Wax. You know, good driving.
Great movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, second time, Ken got a copy of The Car. Nobody's seen The Car in years. It's not even out on DVD anymore. And I said, well, you know, why don't we do this? People want to see this. Well, I'll borrow his copy of The Car. I'll pair it. I went to Dr. Moreau. And, you know, everybody's like, oh, yeah, this is great. This is great. Can't wait to see this. 11 people showed up. So he wanted me to do it this weekend, and I said, you know something? I honestly don't think it's worth it to you. Roll it. Everybody goes to waste, and they go, are all shows like this? I go, no. I said, yeah. I said, well, not all shows are not like this. I said, these people love movies, and they will sit there and watch movies all night. Those of us who aren't, like, drunk and crawling around the lobby and shit,
That's
the thing. And people look at me, and I said, you know, I grew up, and it was no big whoop for me to sit through a triple feature.
Yeah.
You know, people don't have the attention span. They want that, you know, whole video game, wham bam, something's got to happen every 30-second deal, you know?
Yeah, I know.
They don't understand that, like, you know, when we were watching these black and white 50s horror films, it sort of dragged on. They had to drag on because black and white is akin to paneling. It hides an awful lot of mistakes. So
yeah,
you never got to see the monster till the end because the monster sucked, you know.
Yeah,
that type of thing. But we were used to this.
It seems like a lot of the conventions are just they're just autograph conventions now. I mean, it's more of for a guy, I mean, just speaking, for myself, small potatoes guy, for me to go, to a convention, I mean, financially for me, it has to make some sense. I don't need to make money, per se. I'm not having delusions of grandeur with what I do, but, to be able to at least pay for what I spent to get there, and you see a lot of conventions, and I don't think I'm telling tales out of school when you see something like a Horror Hound convention where it's, just selling autographs and photo opportunities for $100, and everybody's charging $30, $40, $50, $60, and then $50 more for a picture. There's not a lot left over, for little guy.
You know what I liked at Cinema Wasteland is it's as much as it is for autographs and for gizmos and films, and it's an event. It's not just autographs. It's a film event. There's always something going on in one of the rooms, and there's people talking about film. There are guys like Pete and other guys. Oh, Pete, I swear I've got to get you together again with Bud Cardos, because Bud Cardos is into all those strange pets too, lizards and Gila monsters, and you guys would get along.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking. I said, yeah, I got to get you and Bud on again too. I keep everything changes. Todd winds up homeless. I wind up getting sick. Everything's weird, But we'll get you and Bud on again. Yeah.
He's got some animal stories that are hilarious. I won't tell you because maybe he'll tell you, and I don't want to blow it. But they are just hilarious.
He told a few when you guys were on before, something about smuggling a chimpanzee on a plane or some shit.
Right, his chimpanzee story is hilarious. He's got another one about a mountain lion in an old hotel outside of Vegas that's hilarious also. But I won't tell you. I'll just tease you.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
Yeah, I definitely got to get you guys on together again.
Todd, are you still with us?
I am still here.
What happened with your film?
We're still doing it. We just got done screening it down in Tampa, and it did really well down there. So we're still screening it around and getting ready to, I wanted to kind of screen it at film festivals and things before I put it out on DVD or Blu-ray. So we're still doing that.
Sure.
And in the meantime, I shot another film. And it's getting ready to get released, so there you go.
Man, you're busy then.
It's been going.
The projects you wrote?
Yes, sir.
Ah, good for you, Todd. I'd love to see one of them.
I appreciate that.
Where will I see him?
Well, we'll have to see what we can do about that.
In the $5.99 bin at Walmart.
That'd be awesome.
I love it. Love it.
That's great.
Where's it going? Where's the distribution of tomorrow? As people aren't necessarily going to the theaters, although this last year was a good year in theater, but all of these, there's some good stuff being shot out there by guys like Todd and myself and this stuff I just did. Where is it going to show? Where's the audience of tomorrow?
Looks like downloads. That's what people are saying.
Downloads.
That's it. You have to make it available. The way people live their life now, and especially the generation that's coming up, it's I want what I want when I want it conveniently as possible.
Well, you know what it is too. It sucks for us genre fans, because I didn't know the Big Gundown came out from Grindhouse on Blu-ray DVD combo, but they want $50 for it, and it's almost out of print. Yeah. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Well, and a big thing now, too, is a lot of companies are putting out, because on the collector's market, for convention fans and genre fans is VHS. VHS is making some sort of ironic comeback now, and a lot of these companies are putting movies out, whether they're, re-releases of, shot on video movies or new movies. A lot of companies are putting them out, and those are going for $30-$40 a crack on VHS.
On VHS. Now, why is that? Because it's not digital? Because it's like purer
thing.
Or something? Or?
It's a hipster
thing. I
think
it's a nostalgia thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to tell you guys something that just happened to me last week. I had this porn video called Fade to Red. Very weird, nondescript box, some chick with a red raincoat on. All right, I have it on 16mm, too. It opens up with a medieval torture scene, pretty hardcore. And I'm like, okay, we know we can sell this. So I had made copies on VHS. It went nowhere. So I put it up on eBay, and I'm thinking, all right, if nobody has this, it's got to be worth something. So I opened the bid at $50 and got put it up for a buy it now at $90. That was on a Sunday night. I go to bed. I wake up Monday morning. I'm blurry-eyed looking over my coffee, and I go, item removed due to, I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? We realized maybe you didn't know about this. And I'm like, yeah, no shit. Something about, I'm reading all this jargon, and at the end it goes, please do not relist this item. I'm like, all right. I don't know what it was. Then I scroll down a PayPal payment. I got $90 for this thing. Somebody bought it before they pulled it. How the hell did this happen? But I'm thinking, all right, what's on that tape that I don't know about?
Yeah.
Because it ain't like I sat there and watched the damn thing. I just copied it. I just made sure there was something on the monitor when I was doing it. When you've been dealing with porn for as long as I have, it's like emptying the trash, you know?
It
doesn't matter anymore, you know? What haven't you seen, you know?
Now, were you advertising on eBay or...?
Yeah, eBay. I just wanted to get rid of it. If I could flip this, you know, for $50, I don't care.
Sure.
Weird. But I've picked up some porn tapes at flea markets that were in clamshell boxes, and I just threw them out, you know, $10, and I've gotten $90 for them. And they are available on DVD, so I don't know what, you know, the big whoop is. Maybe it is a nostalgia thing. Some people are just collecting them for the box.
I think it's that just that big box art, you know, to have it. It's kind of like, you know, how people will go. I mean, I was at a used bookstore one day, and I mean, I buy records, you know, from the used bookstore for the sake of listening to the music on the record. But there was a girl that was in there, and she was buying the Police and Bob Dylan and a Johnny Cash album. And she was talking to the checkout person, and she was just going to put them on the wall. So they were just going to be like, that's what she was going to decorate with, these album covers. And so I think that's, you know, probably a part of it, too, is, you know, they like the artwork. And, you know, the 80s VHS boom was such a fertile time for people like, you know, like myself, discovering Debbie Michaels and and Herschel Gordon Lewis and things. You know, it was a romantic time. And a lot of these, you know, younger people, and I can call them younger people now, you know, didn't get to enjoy that so much, you know. So I think they're kind of hearkening back to a time that was a lot more exciting, maybe, than things are now with releases and the fact there are no video stores and everything has gone digital. You know, some people just want that analog tape, I guess.
Yeah, and there's no box art anymore at all, really.
No, nothing. I mean, a lot of them, especially if you look at Hollywood movies, they're all in, here's the star that's in it. Well, what's it about? I don't know, but it's got Brad Pitt in it. Oh, okay, then.
Yeah.
Well, you know what it is, too? And I had this argument even when DVDs came out, because a lot of these guys, they never grasped the fact that it was the poster art and the ad match that sold the movie. And I'll give you an example. There was two Al Adamson's movies. One was Black Heat, and the other one was Black Something or Other. And what the company did was they modernized the covers. Instead of slapping, you know, the retro, you know, one sheet on the front of it, like MGM was doing with the, you know, the Pam Grier movies and the Jim Brown and Fred Williamson movies, and these things tanked. They tanked horribly because nobody knew what the fuck they were. I said to them, I said, you know, you guys don't seem to get it. What worked then is going to work now because it was the most lurid ads would draw you into the theater. Corey, I'll give you an example. Gary, you saw it. Heading I got on my page on Facebook now with the cannibals and stuff. I just put it up. You guys on it?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the cover for the new magazine. That's going to be the cover for the magazine.
Oh, really?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, I figure, people don't look away from a car wreck. So I figured, let me use this. I took it off some. I think it was a Belgian poster of it or something, but I just, you know, focused on one segment and said, you know, what the hell, let's go for it. So
wow.
So that's what sells.
It's real artwork, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but you think back to, you know, when it was sell sheets and it was, you know, the ad-bats and things, that was all you had to go by because, maybe there was a radio ad or something, but, you know, now, forget it. Something comes out and, you know, but the trailer hits online, it's everywhere, you know, and everybody knows about it. And there's spoilers and there's pictures and there's websites and there's this and there's that. So by the time a movie comes out now, I mean, you've basically already seen it.
Yeah, when you talk about radio spots, Ted was relentless with his radio spots. You know,
Michael,
spend a night in the grave, the corpse riders, the Undertaker and his pals, and I don't know, whatever, the worm eaters, whatever he threw on the end.
I was working
as a meat cutter in the A&P and as apprentice, and they had the music piped in off the radio and stuff, and it was between that and Beast of Blood promos that were driving me crazy because it seemed like every half hour they'd hammer you with this shit, you know. And you had to go see the damn things because you got, wow, it was a head transplant. That must be really fucked up. Let me go see this. So yeah. That's what got you. And it's like Dave Friedman said it best. They lost the art of ballyhoo. They don't know how to ballyhoo something up to get people in the movies. Look at that stupid snuff movie. As shitty as that was, the stupid ballyhoo they pulled with that, and they tripled the ticket price, and they couldn't turn people away. It was
nuts. That's right. Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paranormal Activity. Look at those movies now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they suck.
Yeah.
Terrible. Absolutely terrible.
I can't watch some of this stuff. I finally watched John Dies at the end, and I'm thinking, why doesn't Don recognize better for what he does? Because he's a great filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing. I was like, okay, where is this going? And then, you know, the weird part was I kept watching it and falling asleep for some reason. And I kept, then I got to get through this damn thing. So I sat there, and I'm like, this is really good. The whole way it was put together and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, this was a big production. Why this thing didn't go any, you know, did it even have a theatrical run?
No, I never heard about it. Never.
Nothing.
Nothing. It didn't get out. I don't know why. I talk to Don every once in a while, and he just doesn't, he won't talk about it. It's like something went wrong after. He did a lot of his own marketing. And for some reason, after the, and you'd think with his background, with all the films he made, including Bubba Hotep and that series he did, it was so popular.
Phantasm.
Yeah, the Phantasm movies, you'd think he would be an easy promotion, but you didn't hear a word about John Dies at the End.
No, nothing. And it's a fun movie, and I know that Don was also for, I don't know how many years, having a lot of problems because he wanted to do the follow-up to Bubba Hotep, which was the Bubba Nosferatu movie. And he had Paul Giamatti, and it was going to be a younger Elvis, and Paul Giamatti was going to play Colonel Parker. And I think he had Ron Perlman or something was going to play, I think they thought he was going to play Elvis or something, but that was almost a decade, and he couldn't get it through for some reason. And I thought, with as big of a cult movie as Bubba Hotep was, you would think that was almost an automatic. And then you see a movie like Birdemic or something that it's $1 million to make a sequel, and it's really frustrating. I mean, as a fan and also somebody who's kind of somewhat, you know, around the industry a little bit, it's frustrating to see these really talented guys having that kind of trouble getting an original, you know, great sounding project off the ground.
Well, he went to Warner's originally because Bubba Hotep made a lot of money, and they wanted Bruce Campbell, and Don and Bruce Campbell could never agree on a price or script. Bruce just wanted to change everything. And so Don went ahead on his own, and as you know, he did have Paul Giamatti, and he did have Ron Perlman to play Elvis, and he had all kinds of people connected with it, and his name. But Warner's wouldn't budge. They wanted Bruce Campbell or nothing. And for some reason, isn't that a trip? And so it gradually it just dissipated in negotiations, and that was it.
Yeah, now it's just gone.
Yeah, it's too bad. Because I still run into people that I mentioned Bubba Hotep, and they just freak. They love that movie.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Yeah, yeah, he did it with that.
My wife, I talked her into, it played at a little art house here near Madison, Wisconsin, and I took her to it. And I didn't really tell her what it was. I said, "Well, I said it's Elvis in a nursing home, and it's funny and blah blah blah." I said, "And the director, I said the director's got a track record. He's fantastic." And she goes, "I was into that movie until that monster showed up. I don't understand what was going on." She's not hip to some of these movies, but she, even she, not being a genre fan in any shape or form, she liked the movie too.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, it had so much going for it, and Ossie Davis was just perfect in that part. Man, was he great!
Yeah.
So yeah, it worked on a lot of levels. It. I hope Don gets. I hope he's not one of those directors that directs only 20 years, once every 20 years or something, because he's a talented filmmaker, and we need more of him. Man, we're seeing a lot of crap out there.
Yeah, and a lot of the old guards fading away too, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of the new guys that are out don't really have too much of a voice. There's not much being said.
No, that's true.
You keep going back to the same tired well. It's like you made vampires gay, you made zombies family friendly, you've tamed werewolves. What's next? That's what fucked it up when the corporations got involved and started marketing the stuff to the mass media, then in turn marketing the children. So that's why you don't see it, any horror movies that are rated over PG-13, but we'll give you the additional footage on the DVD for another $20,
for 20.
Yeah, that's how they're getting everybody.
And a lot of the great imagination is gone. The old filmmakers used to have great imagination when they came up. Yeah. Now they do copycat stuff. Oh, I'll just do it. Yeah. Let's do another one, Friday the 13th or whatever. That worked. Yeah. And so they do it. And they do it with actors. So many of the young actors today, I don't want to sound, put them down too much because I love actors. But so many of them have not studied acting at all. They've studied television. And so they're acting film with, that I just want the facts, ma'am, that Joe Friday, CSI Los Angeles kind of monotone, we're just here to get the fact kind of thing, to do it fast and get it over with, because that's how they act on television. So, but it doesn't work in movies, so you have these monotone performances that are just bullshit. They don't excite you, there's no passion, there's no fear.
Yeah. Oh, I got a question for you. Did you ever work with Leo Gordon?
I never did, although I was on the Allied Artists lot working production when Leo did a couple of movies there. So I got to know him and talk with him, but I never worked with him.
Yeah. Now, there was a guy who was completely believable as a heavy. He would scare the shit out of somebody.
Absolutely he would. Yeah. Yeah.
Even Don Siegel said he was the scariest man he ever met.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to meet him in an alley. That's for sure.
You watch some of these old TV shows that they run, like he was mean to Rin Tin Tin. That's how bad he was.
Yeah, he was a nasty guy.
He was incredible. Yeah, next time.
Okay.
All right, well, I want to thank you guys. Thank Gary and Corey for coming on. And until next week, stay sick and we'll see you then.
Short and sweet with 42nd Street Pete. Only on Jackalope Radio.